He will match
40. Well, thanks very much, Freddie, and thanks everybody for coming. It's nice to see so many of you here. As Freddie says, we've got a kind of mixed programme. I'm going to tell you a bit about where we came from in this research unit, QRSTU, and some of our more recent and, we think, significant results. And then Lorna's going to tell you about some research she's been particularly interested in about why it's so hard to get change in surgery and in hospitals. And then Lauren's going to bring you up to date with a range of the things we're doing now with the JR and elsewhere. And now the question is, can I work the technology? Does that work? Yes. I was going to start, as they say, in long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, like when I was appointed as a consultant. The funny thing then is for the younger members of the audience, patient safety wasn't a thing. It didn't really exist as a topic for conversation. And the reason was because we had it already. This was the model of patient safety in those far-off days. Some of you may recognize this guy's face or name. He is one of the 79 Republican candidates for the next presidency. But I thought the cover of his book said it all about what was the traditional, professional, personalized model of why patients are safe. They're safe because we're very good, we work very hard, we're very dedicated, and we know what's going on. And we were genuinely convinced during the early part of my career that that resulted in near optimal results for most people most of the time. And we felt that, yeah, sometimes bad things happen, but it's either an act of God or down to the patient, usually. And then things started to happen in the early 90s. The first rock in the pond was this report from the Institute of Medicine in the USA suggesting that we as a healthcare group were killing about 80,000 patients a year. This was closely followed by a similar publication from the then chief medical officer in the UK with population-adjusted figures showing pretty much the same proportions. And suddenly, this became a big thing, and there was a lot of controversy, and lots of experts started rushing in, and we started to hear about the Swiss cheese, and psychologists like Jim Reason giving us advice on why things weren't working. And then we got lots of other experts coming in to give us helpful advice, particularly from aviation, who told us if we just behave like pilots, everything will be fine, which didn't always go down terrifically. And since then, you know, there's been 10 years of controversy and quite a lot of research. But a strange thing has happened over the last 10 years. Patient safety has become a kind of byword that can be used for almost anything. So nowadays, if you want to close a hospital, you say it's for patient safety. If you want to stop a hospital being closed, you say it's for patient safety. If you want to attack one of your colleagues, you can say you're worried about patient safety. And, of course, if you're the Secretary of State for Health and you want junior doctors to work longer for less pay, you can say it's because of patient safety. The big problem with this, leaving out the politics, is that a word that means everything means nothing. So we've got to decide what we're talking about here before we go any further. And I want to take a leaf out of Humpty Dumpty's book. So those of you who are aficionados of Alice will know what I mean. Humpty Dumpty said, when I use a word, it means exactly what I want it to mean. And this is what I want it to mean. Provision of the highest quality care with 100% reliability. Hard to argue with that. In fact, that's just the same sort of nirvana statement as we would have made in the old days of person-centered professional patient safety. The difference is, how do we get there? I put a big cross through the doctor as hero model. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't carry on trying to be as professional as possible, work as hard as possible, be as dedicated as possible. Of course we should. But if you ask anyone involved in a real high reliability organization if that's enough, they'll tell you, of course not. If you're running a nuclear power plant, it's not good enough just to say our people are very highly trained and very dedicated. If you look at people who run other organizations where we must not make mistakes, you find there are two common features. They design work to make error impossible, wherever possible. Sometimes you just can just make it unlikely. And they develop teamwork and communications to a considerable degree. You put the two together, and you've got pretty much the core of what's called human factors science. Now, Lauren is a human factors expert. Most human factors experts would knit their brows when I say things like that, because that's a rather loose definition, and I'm sure she'll tidy it up for you later. But this is the area we're talking about. This is what our research is focused on. Not looking at the doctors or the nurses or any other professionals, but looking at the system and asking how can we improve things in terms of safety and reliability by focusing on them. So as I say, there are two basic themes here. One is teamwork and communications, and the other is systems redesign. In terms of teamwork and communications, most of the research in medicine has come from aviation and has focused around a kind of teamwork training system called crew resource management, which was originally invented by NASA scientists some 20 plus years ago. And on the systems redesign side, there have been quite a few approaches used, one of which we have concentrated on quite a lot, which is lean. That originally came from Toyota car production. And we've done research on both of them, and we've done a lot of this in the OUH. Starting, this is about 10 years ago now, the CRM teamwork training. I was looking around to see if I remember if anyone here was involved in it. I know Ashok was and a few other people. On the left are the sort of things we did to provide the training. On the right is the syllabus. Not going to go into big detail about that, but you can see the sort of themes. And this is what we found. Did people like it? Yeah, nearly everybody liked it. Did it help? Well, it helped attitudes and behaviors. We had validated scales for measuring these, and we showed that these things improved very significantly. It also helped technical working practices. We had people like Lauren and surgical trainees sit together and observe entire operations and record all the minor glitches and mistakes that happened, and we showed an improvement there. What we didn't show, unfortunately, was a significant improvement in operating time, complications, or length of stay. You can see the numbers. It's a pretty small study. Maybe we needed to do more. But it's interesting that since that was published, that's been reproduced worldwide in many other studies. And in the large majority of those, the answer's been the same. This type of training does seem to have an effect on how teams work together that improves that. It's very hard to show that it has an effect on patient outcomes. So the next thing we did was look at trying to redesign and rationalize the system. And we did some work in the surgical emergency unit here, led by Simon Kreckler, whom many of you will remember. And we had seven different projects running, and we used a lean approach on all of them. If you look at how things were before we started, there we go. This is the sort of baseline performance of the unit. So anything high on the high bar is near 100% compliance are good, and the low bars are bad. And you can see that there was a very variable performance from alcohol gel up to fluid balance before we started. How did lean do in improving things? Well, one of the unfortunate things about science is that you often get mixed answers rather than the sort of eureka you're looking for. And we got some pretty mixed responses with this as well. And my slide's not advancing anymore. Oh, that's a pity. Anyone know how to go to the next one? Let's try that. Oh, there we are. Just hit a button, any button. So the answer was a variable. You know that things got a lot better with some of the projects and hardly seemed to improve at all with others. All the ones with the big p-values pleased us. The other ones, of course, as academics, we like big p-values, and We weren't too keen with the other ones, but when we looked at what the difference between them was, it was effectively that we really had done lean on the ones with the big p-values. In other words, the more PDCA cycles of iterative change we put things through, the better things got. One thing we liked about this research, which we published a couple of years ago, is that we could actually show we'd made a clinical difference. So the graph on the left-hand side of this slide shows the incidence of radiologically detected pulmonary emboli and DVTs in the 6 months after people left the surgical emergency unit. And you can see that the reduction in the post-intervention cohort is about a third. So lean works, but sometimes it doesn't work. We had a bit of a regroup after that. We went back to the world literature and we said, okay, we've tried both of the standard approaches. Is there anything else out there? And what should the next question be? And we found that there wasn't really a lot else out there. Nearly all of the world literature either focuses on trying to improve the interaction of the team, or it focuses on trying to rationalize the system. And oddly, we found that nobody seemed to have asked the obvious question, what about doing both? So we applied for a program grant from NIHR, we're lucky enough to get it, and we've spent the last few years trying to answer that question. And this is called the S3 program. So we ended up actually using three different interventions, not two. The teamwork intervention stayed the same. We still did lean, but we also introduced a slightly different way of improving the system, which we've labeled standard operating procedures. Again, I don't have time to go into details, but lean is all about trying to get the frontline staff to take the initiative and make the changes. With standard operating procedure approach, there's a bit more emphasis on getting experts to provide some of the lead. So we did five studies in the end because we wanted to look at combinations. So we had a study where we just looked at standard operating procedures, one where we just looked at lean, one where we just looked at teamwork training, and then we had two overlap studies, teamwork training and SOP and teamwork training and lean. And this is the sort of study design we used, which in the field of patient safety, I have to say, was a bit radical because we introduced this thing called a control group. That's actually quite uncommon in this field for a number of practical reasons. So we had observation before and after an intervention, and in between we either had an intervention or no intervention in the control group. We did this in about five hospitals in three trusts, including this one, and these are the five studies as we've mentioned. So the aims were to look at question one, which is better, tackling the team or tackling the system? Second question, to me the most important one, is a combined intervention better than doing either alone? And the third one was to try and understand the influences on what works and what doesn't work. And Lorne is going to tell you more about that. What do we evaluate? None of these studies were enormous in terms of randomized clinical trials because we were doing studies that involved observing entire operations using two people. And you can't do thousands and thousands of cases using that kind of methodology. Because we had a control group and an active group, the logical thing to do in terms of evaluating the results was to look at the difference between before and after in the active group and compare it to the difference between before and after in the control group. So that's called a difference in difference approach. And we looked at teamwork, non-technical skills. This is a validated psychometric test we've developed based on some aviation work in the past. The glitch count just measures technical performance, small mistakes and errors. We looked at how good people were at doing the WHO, and we looked at clinical outcomes. And there were also a few project-specific measures, depending on the specific circumstances. Right, findings. We just published on this. There are a couple of papers in Annals of Surgery. I think it's still online. But to try and summarize these results, I'm going to go through this in the next slide quite slowly because the answers were a bit complicated. So this answers the question, which is better, to tackle the system or to tackle the team? If you look at non-technical skills, you can see in both groups the mean improved. Doesn't look like a big improvement, but this scale actually hardly ever goes outside the 70s. So it's quite a significant improvement in both cases, but no significant difference between the two approaches. Which is quite interesting because the teamwork approach trains people to work in teams, and the systems approach doesn't at all. But it also improved teamwork. If you look at the glitch count, you can see that actually the teamwork group got worse. Now, that's not a take-home message. We don't think that CRM makes technical performance worse. In fact, the control groups got worse as well, at more or less the same rate. But that didn't happen with the systems approach. That actually did make the glitch rate better. With the WHO, we used three different measures, and they were all over the place. So if we look at whether people actually attempted the timeout, we found that teamwork training made that better, but from a low base. The systems group were already good and they didn't get any better. So we didn't know what to make of that. With the sign out, both groups got better, but there was a significant advantage for the systems approach and the opposite for timeout compliance. So if you're looking for a sun headline out of this, which is better, the answer is don't know. So looking at the other question, is it better to do a single intervention or to combine the two? Again, non-technical skills improved across the board, so that didn't help us. The glitch rate, the technical performance, again, was slightly worse if you took all the single interventions together and pulled the data. And that was largely pulled down by the teamwork training intervention that we saw earlier. But the combined group produced a pretty dramatic improvement in technical performance. On the WHO, there was a pretty much of a tie in terms of timeout attempts, but the combined approach was significantly better in terms of the other types of evaluation of the WHO. So I think it's safe to say there's a clear winner here. Combining the two approaches does make things better. It's perhaps better illustrated on this graph, which shows you the effect size estimates for teamwork, that's on the top with no text, and for technical performance. And on both sides, the big red arrow helps. This is where we did the combined approach, and you can see that's the clear winner. So brief summary of about 4 years' work. The conclusion is pretty simple and not that unexpected, but it is important because it seems that this is the first time anyone's done this. And if we are correct, safety interventions in the future need to have not just one component, but two. You need to approach both the teamwork aspect and the systems aspect. But we also had one other major observation about the 4 years' work. It was exhausting. It was very, very difficult to get any of these five interventions implemented. Now, I'm sure many clinicians will sympathize with that feeling because they've tried this too. And actually, it's not just us. I've had discussions with the professor of ergonomics at Loughborough, Sue Hignett, who actually did her thesis on this and is convinced that for various reasons, healthcare is genuinely more difficult to manage change in than many other environments. And we were fascinated by that, and we decided to analyze what worked and why it worked, and what were the problems that we kept coming up against. And that's what Lorna's going to talk about in the next section of today's meeting. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. So, as Peter said, we already found out from the qualitative or the quantitative results that combined approaches were more effective than either single approach on its own. But we wanted to find out why that was. We also wanted to explore why it was so difficult to do the improvement work, what were the barriers to frontline staff actually doing that work, whether there were any facilitators involved in the S3 project, and whether there were any strategies that the S3 project discovered to overcome some of those barriers to doing improvement work and to introducing change. And the reason that this was important to understand why is patient safety interventions and these types of interventions are really complex. It's really difficult to actually identify what are the active components that are making it effective and to actually identify what is contributing to the changes. And so it's really important to understand that, what affects implementation if you then want to replicate those results in future. And so I undertook the qualitative study in collaboration with Professor Graham Martin, who is a professor in the Sapphire Group at the University of Leicester. And we conducted a number of semi-structured interviews with staff that had been involved in the S3 project. And this included both healthcare staff and members of the S3 research team that had been involved. And we used semi-structured interviews so as to not restrict the interviewees to the questions designed by the researchers. And we conducted 34 interviews in total. The methods that we used for analysis were based on a method called the constant comparative method. And the idea of this is that you analyse your data as you're collecting it. And that way you generate theories, and that helps you to better form your questioning as you go forward in analysis. So then Graham and I both coded the data independently, and it was analysed for themes independently to make sure that it was more objective. And so in terms of the different approaches, what we found was that in terms of those staff that were trained in teamwork-only approaches, they felt that they had a much greater awareness of patient safety issues and the risks around them. But actually, they felt that they didn't necessarily have the skills or the practical knowledge or the tools to then address those issues within the system, and they found that really frustrating. They also found that the teamwork approach was very difficult to sustain in the long term. When we looked at those who were in the systems-only groups, such as the Lean, staff in those groups felt that they actually had some skills to address the issues. But what we found was that some of their improvement activity wasn't necessarily always very patient safety focused. And then, I suppose, somewhat unsurprisingly, was we found then, supporting the quantitative results, that combined approaches were better than either on their own, and that staff were more aware of the patient safety issues, but they also had the practical knowledge and skills to address those issues. But what was really, I think, very interesting about the combined approach was that in this group, although they had a greater awareness and they said that they felt that they had more skills, this was a group that seemed to acknowledge the complexities of actually making change and how hard this work is. And as a result of that, they actually requested more support from the S3 research team and more expertise in human factors. And they were the groups that actually exhibited more fear and concern about the withdrawal of the support from the research team going forward. And so that was looking at the different approaches that we used. But as Peter mentioned, we also wanted to look at why this work is so difficult, why staff find it really hard to do, and what are the issues that they experience, the barriers, and how we can overcome that, and how S3 did overcome some of that. And so we organized the findings under means, motive, and opportunity. And this is loosely based on a framework kind of from the management and science world. And the concept is that if you want staff to engage in a behaviour, they first have to be motivated to do that behaviour. If you can get your staff motivated to do that, they then need the means, the resources, or the skills in which to do that. But they also need the opportunity and time. And so if you're missing one of these elements, the occurrence of the behaviour is not likely to happen. And so in terms of motive, before the S3 project, staff felt that they didn't really want to get involved in a project like this. They weren't really that interested in change or in new improvements. They've been through so many initiatives, so many changes. They didn't know why it would be any different, and they're really, really fed up, and there's a lot of change fatigue in the NHS. But what was interesting was that they found that after S3, that this had been overcome. So they felt that the S3 team had a different approach, and actually it was different to other initiatives and other changes that they've been involved in the past. So one of the things that they liked was that they were allowed to be involved and lead on the projects, and they were making decisions. Training from the S3 team helped them to become convinced that they actually could challenge some of the issues and that there were solutions out there. They felt that one of the things that was really useful and motivated them was the fact that some of the projects, the team communicated the progress, and even if there was failures, learning from those failures throughout the projects. And overall, they felt that the S3 team was very different to other initiatives that they've been involved in before. The S3 team built relationships with them and involved them throughout the process, and they were leading. So that helped to overcome some of the motivation issues. In terms of means, so prior to the S3 project, staff felt that, well, what's the point in getting involved in something like this? It's just going to fail. We don't know how to fix it. We're not sure what to do. And there was actually a lot of learned helplessness and a lack, or what they perceived to be a lack of knowledge or skills. But afterwards, particularly for the systems groups and the combined interventions, staff felt that they had skills and that they've been empowered by the S3 team to actually make changes at the front line. But as I said before, particularly for the combined groups, staff did say, although they felt that they had some skills to make change, they did have some concerns about not having that expertise or support from the research team. And so, opportunity. This, out of all three, was probably the most significant factor during the S3 project. So everyone knows that clinical priorities are going to be first, and there is actually no time or no set-aside time in which staff can actually do quality improvement work. So all of these staff are getting involved in the projects, but realistically, they have no time to do it. And so people who were involved felt that they had to do it on their personal time, breaks outside of work. And while the S3 research team did help to try and support them and facilitate time, there is just no extra time or no set-aside time for this work to occur. And it's really difficult for that. And also, in addition to actually having the time, even just finding the space, you know, or a room to actually meet and talk about that kind of work was actually really difficult to find as well. So out of the means, motive and opportunity was definitely the most constraining factor on the S3 project. And we did identify some other barriers to improvement which have been found elsewhere in the literature as well. So organisational, culture and context. So when you're thinking about the context of a project, trying to make sure that improvement goals are aligned with the organisation and that the organisation is actually supporting improvement work, which leads into the second point about senior leadership and support. So making sure that seniors are actually supportive of more junior staff that are involved in this work. And we actually had a lot of examples in the qualitative work where some of the more junior staff did have some fears about getting involved in terms of becoming in conflict with more senior staff, or as to be seen as if they got involved in PDSA or PDCA cycles that then failed, that they would be seen as failing in front of their seniors. And sustainability is a really difficult one, and in particular we noticed that when you do this type of work, you get champions or one or two people who lead on the projects. But of course, in healthcare, people rotate and people move frequently. And so it's really difficult to get that sustainability if you only have one or two people leading on those projects. And so we've learned all of these different things from the S3 project, and they've allowed us to develop the model of training and support that we now use today as part of the Patient Safety Academy. And they've informed a lot of other areas of research with it that we're now working on and some of our current work. So I'm now going to hand over to Lauren, who's going to talk a little bit more about our current work.
Thanks, Lorna. So I'll give you a brief overview of some of the projects that we're involved in, and then I'm going to go into more depth on two of them to illustrate some of the different focuses of the research group. One of the main things that we've become involved in more recently is supporting the trust in its change priorities, and particularly in the areas of incident investigation. So we have a number of skills within the team of specialists that are not commonly found within organisational trusts, and so we've been involved in investigating the NEVER events and the kind of recommendations that come out from the structured analysis that is proposed by the human factors literature allows a different set of recommendations and a different approach to mitigating the kind of risks that are commonly found within the types of NEVER events and other events that are commonly seen within our organisations and others. We do a lot of applied human factors work, so the day job, rather than supporting others in making change, actually using the skills that we learnt in university to develop different projects. And these are different IT projects and also a project within pharmacy. SEND, some of you may be familiar with on your wards, that was developed from a very human factors design point of view and has resulted in really pleasing levels of user satisfaction and reduced impact on clinical time from introducing an IT system, which is quite rare within our hospital systems. We're developing new research agendas around the failure to rescue and the management of acutely unwell patients, and also looking at what the new models for change might be. So we know that change is difficult, and we now know what the barriers are. And so what will the design of our interventions look like in the future that can make sustainability more likely, make sure that there's the provision for the opportunity for staff to get involved? And we also, a large part of our work is still around the human factors training and support for quality improvement projects. And those are through both the Patient Safety Academy and also with the Academic Health Science Network, the Patient Safety Collaborative. So I'm going to talk in a bit more detail about the Patient Safety Academy and also the OARS project, which is one of the new IT projects within the Trust. So the Patient Safety Academy is run jointly between the Quality, Reliability, Safety and Teamwork Unit and OCSTAR. So I'm sure when some of you heard human factors, you were thinking of the simulation type training that's run through OCSTAR with Dr. Helen Higham at the helm, which is done very, very well, and probably some of the best, we have some of the best simulation opportunities here within this trust than we do throughout the whole of the NHS. So please do take the opportunity to experience those if you have the chance. We're funded jointly within the Patient Safety Academy by the Academic Health Science Network through Health Education Thames Valley, and they've secured our funding for a longer time period now, which is relieving in the face of government cuts. And so the model of training and support that we've got follows that from S3. So we still follow this pre-intervention, setting ourselves up for change and the intervention, and post-intervention phases. And we felt that was really useful in terms of helping people structure how they approach this. During the pre-intervention phase, we do a lot of engagement work, getting people involved, letting them understand the reasons behind the change. Some training on the skills required, an agreement on project, and really importantly, collecting on the data of the baseline data of how it is that the systems that they're working within are work at the moment, so that they can direct change in the most appropriate place. The intervention involves making the changes, and that can be through PDCA cycles or whatever model that the team feel appropriate, and providing support from our team in helping them complete that. And post-intervention, collecting the data again. And this model for training and support is different to what's commonly used. So the IHI framework very much says, get in, do some PDCA cycles, see how you're doing, and evaluate and iterate quickly. And really what we found from the work that we've been doing is that if you put the work in up front, understanding what the problems are, getting people engaged in your change, when it comes to making your PDCA cycles and when it comes to making change in your workplace, people are aware of what you're doing. They're more likely to contribute. They're going to help. They might collect a bit of data for you. They might help you iterate. And so that's the change in our model from what is widely supported in the other organisations that focus on this kind of thing. We have a number of different work streams under the PSA that we focus this improvement work on. A couple in acute surgery, and these are across the region in Oxfordshire, not just within this trust. We also work within primary care, or we're starting to work within primary care. We have a senior leader instant external review programme that we're developing that I'll elaborate on in a second. We have been working a little bit in mental health, and we've also got some regional courses where anyone that outside these themes wants to get involved can have an opportunity to bring a team and get some training and support, and we support the PSC. So in terms of the instant external review programme, the first thing was to get sign up from the trust. And so this was an idea that we do incident investigation within our own organisations that allow us to understand the incidents, and you know, some of the incidents that happen here will be nigh on identical to the incidents that happen at Wexham Park or happen at other hospitals within our region. And some of the complexities around analysing an incident can be confounded by the fact that you might have your friend or enemy investigating the incident within you, and that ends up with a focus on the personal issues, which is not necessarily appropriate in terms of if we want to make change. We know that firing people and getting rid of medical staff is never going to stop the next never event, so we should just not do that. So the first stage in the external review programme was to get sign up from all the different trusts, that actually the idea of why don't we investigate each other's trusts, that will facilitate us learning from each other and will also take out some of these difficulties around who our friends are. I'm happy to say that all the trusts in the region signed up, and ours was the first to do that. I'm really strong proponents of that. So I think we have a very forward-thinking medical director and now chief executive that is really interested in this stuff. So the board then identified the cohort of staff that they felt would be appropriate to be visiting other trusts to investigate their incidents and what kind of personal skills they would need to have. And then that cohort then get training in the real skills around incident investigation. So not just how to do a root cause analysis, but really what are the skills that we want to be, what are the tools that we want to be using to investigate incidents in a systematic way. Then alongside them, we need to design the process. What will this look like? How many incidents do we investigate externally? How is it appropriate that we investigate incidents with patient harm, or actually could we test the process by investigating incidents that were near misses, and that would, you know, take some of the heat out of the situation? Or you know, what's the time process when you're inviting someone in to come and investigate? Do we think that a day is okay, or do we want them to take 5 months before they prepare their report? And what are the artifacts going to look like? We need to make sure that these are supportive of what the processes. Then we hope the teams will then do some incident investigations, and then we need to evaluate this system to make sure that it works. And so we're currently at the training phase, so we've identified the cohort. More members always welcome, but we've got a cohort that we're happy with, and they will be trained on the tools in the next at the end of the month. And the regional courses are open for applications. This is a blatant advertising post if any of you are interested in coming and learning a little bit more, or some of you already have and might want refreshers or whatever, that those are open and you can get in touch with us for that. So I'm going to speak lastly about the OARS project. And so OARS stands for Oxford Acute Referral System, and plays on our love of rowing here within the university. So OARS is really an electronic system to support managing patients across our network. So although it's named as a referral system, actually, we hope through the design that we can support the management of patients locally as well as support their management within the trust. So I'm going to illustrate the process as is for referral into our trust, which I'm sure is very familiar to all of you, but when I first came across this area of patient care, I was quite surprised. So we have our time going down the slide, and we've got, if you can imagine, a referring hospital and us as the specialist centre. So we've got a patient in our referring hospital who is seen by a clinician in our referring hospital, and that clinician thinks, do you know what, I think you need care by the specialist centre. So they pick up the phone to OUH and say, oh, I want to speak to the registrar or whoever to talk about this patient. Registrar says, yes, I'll go and chat to the consultant or whoever, and they then feed back the plan to perhaps the new person who's now on call, who then rings back to the referring hospital, but the person at the referring hospital might have now changed. They need to confer with a different person what the plan for that patient was, and then they feed back, and then that team might have rotated again, and then they ring Oxford again and say, oh, yeah, we've now got the test results that you asked for, and the person on the end of the phone goes, what test results, what patient? So they then confer with their colleagues to say, oh, well, I've got these test results about that patient. They said, okay, please can you feed that back to them that they now might be able to come over. So then they speak to a different person about managing the transfer of the patient. They then ring back to speak to the bed manager, say, yeah, it might be a good time to send the patient over now. Can you make the arrangements? So she says, yes, I'll speak to your bed manager. So they ring back and speak to the bed manager, and then they arrange the transfer. And then we might input the patient details on the electronic patient record to get the patient input a wristband when they arrive to get all the care that they need. And then finally in all of this, the patient might come to our hospital or not. And so really some of, you know, I talked about the best case scenario here, really. Some of those people sometimes aren't available on the end of the phone, and so that results in repeated time calls. And sometimes the process might be documented, sometimes it won't. We have no control over what documentation is made at the referring hospital. And, you know, the message that's passed on the phone may be corrupted, or it may be not on purpose, but you know that it might not be communicated properly. And so some of those lines of communication end up being lost. And so the OARS system, what we've done is take a step back and say, let's understand this process. Let's find out where the weaknesses are, and the weaknesses are not in the humans in the system. The weaknesses are in what the supporting architecture is around around the referral system. And so how can we facilitate it? What is it that people need to know? Well, from analysis of what kind of the number of repeat calls that we get, it's that actually the plan for the patient is getting lost, and the history of the conversation of what was done for this patient is lost along the way. And so we came up with this Facebook-like conversation idea. And so the patient is in the referring hospital, and the clinician goes to the OARS database and enters the patient details on that and says, I want to refer you. And that messages the person in the referring hospital to say, oh, you've got a new referral. Here's the baseline information about this patient. What would you like to do? And they say, OK, can you please give me these test results? So they write back, and then a different person can access the system and see all of the information that's already happened. And so it goes on. And it doesn't matter who you are, where you are, what time you're accessing. We're all accessing the same central message of truth, if we like, about the patient. And so eventually or not, the patient might move to our hospital in the same way. Hopefully that might be a smoother process because the EPR person might have been able to log onto the system and get their details and put those into EPR so their wristband is ready and waiting when they arrive, which would be radical. And so the OARS system there is really to try and say, let's try and support people to do the job that they're doing in the best way that they possibly can. And so the log on is just using your normal trust address. And then the kind of screen that we've got built within the system is a conversation screen where you've got a timeline history, you've got the patient demographics at the top, and then you can see the conversation of who and the different decisions that have been made about the patient, and the ultimate decision of managed locally, which then has to have consultant level approval so that we are supporting the trust aims of 7-day working. But that, of course, you can access this from wherever you are. So if the decision is to manage locally and you need to approve it, but you're on the golf course, it might be a bit easier. Not suggesting you're on the golf course. And so the next stages for OARS are that, first of all, we need to check that what we've done makes people happy, and that in the trial system that we've got at the moment, we're going live in neurosurgery at the end of the month. And really our focus is on evaluating to make sure that that has the functionality to really support all of their tasks. And we need to collect data to make sure that implementing such an IT project saves clinical time, improves the processes, and doesn't increase any risks in any areas. I'm a very strong proponent that we should not be increasing risk when we change a system. We need to understand what our current risks are and mitigate them. We need to add new functionality. This is our first version, and there's lots of things. You know, our wish list is extensive, and there's lots of things that we'd like. And most of all, you know, a big... The Trust has been a big supporter of this development, and it's the first, it's a new model for the Trust where it's trust funded but developed by a local IT company with a clinician-led development with myself. And so they were very strong that they needed it to be a solution for the whole of the Trust, not just for neurosurgery. So this is neurosurgery first, vascular assigned up to be the next speciality. But if you're sat in the audience thinking, actually, this would be quite a smart solution for our patients as well, we're looking for who would be the next specialities that would take this on. So please do get in touch. You know, this has been developed to fit the referral process. I'm sure that many of you saw that was familiar to you. So if yours is different, then we're interested in exploring that as well. And so lastly, what the Quality, Reliability, Safety and Teamwork Unit has been able to demonstrate over the last few years is that the work in safety and quality of care is complex, and it's not a one-size-fits-all, and really doing this with to develop an evidence base takes time and mostly takes the collaboration with the clinical colleagues that we see sat around the room here today and in all of the trusts around our region. And so, you know, what we do is clinically relevant, and therefore it's appropriate that we're working within the trust, but honestly we couldn't do it without working with everyone. So here's a short roll call of some of the people that we've worked with within and outside the trust, and also some of the organisations that have supported us. And really, without these faces and others that weren't Googleable, then we couldn't have done the work that I would say is quite fulfilling as a human factors practitioner. So thank you very much, and we'll ask some questions.